Is 484, what is it, a 484 number? Do I need to?
I think he just called her.
No, I've got her here. She's
okay.
Yeah.
Good. Because there's a 484 in the Q&A, but I'll leave that there.
Yep, we're good. All righty. This is Brenda Jones with Narsol in Action and Larry Neely. Blah, my goodness, you can sure tell I just got here. And anyway, welcome
either
to Narsol in Action. Huh?
No, go
either
ahead.
That, yes. Okay.
You and Larry had a very exciting day.
Yes. I certainly did. I got caught in traffic and I came flying in here at about 5 minutes before the call, so I'm just getting set up. So thank you. Welcome, everyone. And I'm Executive Director. Larry Neely is our esteemed paralegal and primary talker on this here show. And we're an all-volunteer organization. We rely on lots of volunteers. All of us are volunteers here, and we encourage anybody listening to become a member of NARSOL, volunteer your time, and get active in your state if there's an organization there. It's only through our collective efforts that we're able to do all that we do, because nobody can really take this on alone. These conference calls are intended to provide members and supporters with the opportunity to receive information about our work, as well as tell you about important events as they're unfolding. And that is, in fact, what is going on tonight. We're introducing you to some of the good news that's happening in Colorado. And I'll be working the phone, and if time permits us, I'll help with answering questions. So, Larry, at this point, would you like to take it away?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Brenda, and welcome, everybody. And we have hopefully a good program coming tonight. There certainly is a lot of interest. This is the most people we've ever had on a conference call in the history of doing these for a couple of 3 years, however long we've been doing them. So we have the attorney that's handled this important case, Allison Ruttenberg, with us, and she's going to answer questions both from me and from you, hopefully. But Allison practices law in Boulder as a solo practitioner, and Boulder is one of my favorite cities in the United States, one of the most beautiful college campuses on the planet. And she's been practicing for 25 years. She primarily represents low-income people who need help in the criminal justice system to be treated fairly. So she does divorce, child custody, DHS, bankruptcy, employment law, and she's just a person who has an extreme passion for providing service to people who otherwise would not receive a fair shake in the system. And we're just so delighted that between all the hundreds of emails and phone calls that she's been getting, that she's agreed to spend a little bit of her time with us tonight. And welcome, Allison. We really thank you for coming in with us tonight.
Thank you.
So we're gonna try to move quickly through the questions that I have composed, and then we're going to try to take your questions. Those of you who signed up, you would have gotten an email from me. Maybe you have not opened it, but we ask you to please direct your question at this case that we're talking about. We really can't hear your stories tonight about how bad something may be in your state, because the registry is almost universally bad in every state. I think everybody would say it is universally bad in every state. So those stories won't be helpful. But what we're hoping to find out is what this secret formula was that got this decision, and maybe how that can be replicated. So, Allison, again, welcome. I'm going to start with my questions. And I'm going to ask, as I always do, to try to make the answers as concise as possible. Attorneys, and I know even paralegals love to talk. I love to talk, but we're going to try to get information to people that they can understand in a useful fashion as we go through this. And I don't have as many questions as I typically prepare, because this case is procedurally in a different posture than what we talked about last month, which was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So, did you have any further introduction, or do you want to get straight down to the questions?
Why don't we get straight to the questions?
Thank you. So, um, So what has your involvement been with this case? And I'm calling it Millard versus Rankin. So if I were to talk about the case, I'll either say the case or Millard v. Rankin. So what has your involvement been with this case?
Well, Mr. Millard contacted me in 2012 and wanted to see if there was any way he could get off the registry early. I mean, he thought he would have to be on the registry for 10 years. As it turns out, the statute has changed, unfortunately, and under state law, he could not petition off the registry anyway. He's subject to lifetime registration. So I knew that the only way really to challenge that was to make a constitutional challenge. At that time, I had more faith in the federal courts than our state court system. I could have challenged it under the Colorado Constitution. I decided to challenge it under the federal Constitution. So I've been involved right from the very start, and I've had a lot of support, as in you go girl type of support from my colleagues, but no actual support. I've done this solo the entire time.
That is remarkable. I know that we didn't know about the case until you were well into the process, where that the state had filed a motion and the judge had denied that motion, and we reached out to you and we're there now, and we were there then, and we want to be supportive in any way we can. But for those who have not read the complaint, I actually have read it. But tell us what you alleged in your complaint. What were the issues that you found problematic with Colorado's registration?
Well, I mean, I alleged that the way that registry works in effect is it's not just some administrative notification or administrative reporting requirement. It has the effect of actual punishment because of the way it's published and the way laypersons and government officials alike misinterpret the information on the registry and then use that to draw all of these unwarranted conclusions about people. So, I mean, I set forth as many facts as I could regarding what was happening to these people in their lives, you know, kind of telling their stories of life on the registry to show that there were constitutional issues here, not just Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual, but due process issues as well, especially with respect to the juvenile offenders. When I first started the lawsuit, I had one plaintiff who was adjudicated as an 11-year-old and is now being compelled to register as an adult. And she was homeless and had trouble maintaining employment. And unfortunately, she disappeared on me sometime in 2015, and I haven't heard from her since, which is one of the problems with my homeless clients. So, you know, and I at one point I had a mentally ill gentleman who just couldn't remember to register, didn't understand how to register, and he picked up half a dozen or more failure to register criminal cases as a result. So my goal in the complaint was to just lay out the facts so that I could show that this was not just some administrative consequence of a conviction, but there are facts to support that it was actual punishment.
Well, just for the record, there was not just one complaint. I believe that your case actually moved forward after you amended the complaint for the fourth time. Is that correct? That was the fourth complaint. So my point is, you kept reworking this and reworking it. You didn't just draw up one complaint and draft one complaint. You worked before.
Correct. excuse me. I kept having to amend it because mainly because of the turnover in plaintiffs. You know, plaintiffs kept dropping out. My homeless plaintiff disappeared on me. The mentally ill plaintiff just couldn't cope with discovery. Excuse me. One person moved out of state, and then a couple of other people were reincarcerated in the DOC, and were no longer really, you know, good test plaintiffs for this.
Well, I'm building up to explain to our audience how long and how much work goes into one of these cases. Mr. Millard contacted you in 2012. You finally, I believe, you were ready and prepared. You filed your first complaint September 4th, 2013. We're having this call 4 years later.
Yeah, correct. and part of that is because it got assigned to Judge Mage. I mean, there's good and bad with Judge Mage. The good is that he's a maverick. He's an independent thinker. I was very glad to draw him, but the downside is he also does everything by himself. He does not delegate anything to the magistrates, and as a result, he's slow.
So
cases move on his docket very slowly.
So other states and other people that are listening to this call, I'm assuming there are some attorneys out there listening to this call, they're going to want to know about your plaintiff selection process and how important that, what role that played and could play going forward in putting together one of these cases. How critical is that, and how did you select your plaintiffs? And of course, you've already said you lost some of them and had to substitute plaintiffs, but how critical do you see that in terms of this type of litigation?
Well, that's important because you want to pick plaintiffs who will be good test subjects. I wanted plaintiffs who were done with their sentences, done with their treatment, and had stayed out of the criminal justice system ever since.
So,
and also had horrific experiences on the registry. There's a couple people who the registry doesn't really impact that badly, and they're not good plaintiffs because, you know, in order to show punishment, you have to show these guys are experiencing it.
So I'm going to drill a little deeper here. So you wanted people who had completed their debt to society.
Completed their sentences, were off paper completely.
Okay, and so that was a high priority. So you were focusing on this as punishment after they've paid their debt to society.
Exactly.
And then did whether or not they would be a sympathetic plaintiff, did that factor in any way into your decision and your selection?
Well, you know, this was a bench trial, and I've noticed that Judge Mage is very sympathetic towards the way sex offenders are treated, so I wasn't so much worried about that. You know, from the public standpoint, there isn't such a thing as a sympathetic sex offender. But what I wanted was people that would catch Judge Mach's attention, that they really were experiencing actual, not hypothetical, theoretical punishment, but it was actually impacting them in their everyday lives.
So, well, that's good to know, because my personal opinion is that we have to focus very significantly on people who have paid their debts to society. I think the Supreme Court confirmed that in the Packingham decision. They were disturbed by those restrictions on people who have paid their debt to society. And so that did factor into your decision. You've already touched on a little bit. You picked federal court, and one of my questions was, that's kind of a gutsy decision, because nobody until Doe versus Snyder was winning in federal court very much. And at the time you filed this, Doe versus Snyder hadn't been decided. So what gave you the faith that the federal system would be a better place? I know we're having a discussion in my state of New Mexico, and everybody's telling me our state court is so much better than federal court, and we would never dare go to federal court. And we're certainly rethinking our position here based on what you've done.
Well, there's been a rash of good decisions coming out on the issue of the constitutional rights of sex offenders, mainly from Judge Mage, Judge Jackson, and Judge Martinez here in Colorado. So I was hoping I would get assigned to one of those three, and luckily I did. But, you know, our Colorado Court of Appeals and Colorado Supreme Court are so conservative, almost to the point of being intellectually dishonest, that I just felt that I had a better shot in federal court.
So, well, I'm going to get this question. Isn't conservative good for our cause from the judiciary point of view?
Well, I mean, conservative to the point of being intellectually dishonest, I've seen the Colorado Court of Appeals bend itself into like an intellectual pretzel trying to avoid recognizing the constitutional rights of offenders, and I just didn't think that I would get a fair shake from them. There's only one panel of the Colorado Court of Appeals that I thought I would, and only a handful of district court judges I would want to end up in. If I am going to file anything in state court, I would file it in Denver, where I think I would have the best possible chance, but I just had more faith in our federal court here in Denver.
So, well, I have been a resident of Colorado, and I remember I was there in the early 80s, and I remember Judge Mache, and I concur with your assessment. He's an independent thinker and very thorough, and you were lucky to draw him as a judge. I don't know all your options that you could have drawn, but I can't think of anyone I would rather have drawn at the time I was there who I remember. Is it safe to assume, well, what I try to help our listeners understand is that the state will do everything that they can, when these lawsuits are filed, the state will do everything they can to avoid having a case decided on the merits. Is it safe to assume that Colorado did everything they could to prevent this from being decided on the merits? Were there motions for dismissal, for lack of standing, for no justiciable controversy, for summary judgment? How hard did they try to prevent this case from going to trial?
They fought it pretty hard. I mean, first there was the motion to dismiss, and then after. After I prevailed on the motion to dismiss and we had the scheduling conference, Judge Mache was pretty stern when he was talking to the Assistant Attorney General on the case. He said, look, you know, don't clutter up my docket with a bunch of other motions. I mean, this case is going to trial. And they filed a motion for summary judgment anyway, which I thought would kind of incur their wrath. And I think that did motivate him to... you know, be extra vigilant about the trial. But, you know, he was very clear where he thought that this stated a viable cause of action and he was going to see it through.
So, well, it's been my experience in cases I've been involved with and observed and been around the country that everything possible that can be done to avoid a trial on the merits is going to happen. So it was no different in your case.
Correct.
So let's move towards the trial. So once they failed in their efforts to prevent a trial, help our audience understand what it means to go to trial. What before a case proceeds to trial, what would you need to do in terms of getting this ready for witnesses? Do you just show up one day and hope for the best, or do a little mini trial preparation? Tell people what is involved in getting this case postured for trial. I know each judge is different and each case is different, but set us up for trial here.
Well, first of all, you know, because my clients had no money, I was flying by the seat of my pants. I did not take depositions in this case, which I know most civil lawyers would be horrified at. Most civil lawyers don't want to go to trial unless they've deposed every single witness and know exactly what they're going to say at trial. But I just decided that nobody could afford depositions and we had nothing to lose, so why not? We would just fly by the seat of our pants. So I didn't have depositions to prepare from. I had to make sure that I hit all the elements of the constitutional claims I was trying to prove, so I had to make sure that all my witnesses would hit the elements in one way or the other, and then I just had to corral my witnesses and get them ready to testify, be sure I had my exhibits in order, be sure that I had, that the Attorney General wouldn't be able to make evidentiary objections against any of my exhibits, which they certainly did. I mean, they certainly put me through the ringer trying to keep out some of my exhibits, but I pretty much got in everything I wanted to get in, and we had a very smooth trial as a result. Anybody who's ever tried a case in front of Judge Mache knows that you better be prepared and you better cooperate with the other side regarding evidence and exhibits, otherwise you just incur his wrath.
So the expense of depositions, you basically didn't have the money, and you took a calculated risk, but you still had to corral witnesses, and you had to go through witness preparation, and you had possibly cost of getting these witnesses to court since some of them were homeless And did you typically we use expert witnesses? Did you use any expert witnesses that had to be compensated in this case?
No. See, right from the start, Judge Mates said, "I don't want to hear from experts. This is not an expert case." He said, "This is a case on the facts of what these people experienced on the registry. So I want to hear facts from sex offenders and their family members. I do not want to hear from experts," which was a huge relief to me because we could not afford that, and I was worried about that from the start. I had talked to the executive director of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar about them helping out on expert witnesses if it came down to that, but, you know, fortunately, that was an expense we avoided.
Well, I remember at the time I contacted you, you had that determination that you weren't going to need help, but our organization is also standing there ready if needed for going forward, and we were there. But at that point, you had decided that experts were not going to be needed, which is fantastic. I don't believe we can count on that in future litigation going forward as a general rule that people are going to be in a position where they can do these cases without experts, like in a case where we're assisting with in Rhode Island where they're effectively have banished everyone if that statute is not challenged to remove people from their homes. They're going to need experts, and they're going to be very costly experts, and that's one area where we're helping out. So let's get into the decision itself. The judge found that the statute violates the 8th and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And before I phrase up the question, what does that mean? Clarify that who bears the burden of showing that when a constitutional challenge, where is the burden placed in terms of proving that something's not constitutional? Is that on us or is that on the government?
That's on us.
Okay.
It's always on the plaintiff.
Okay. And what is that standard? I believe it's by the clearest of proof. Am I correct? We have to show by the clearest of proof that a statute is unconstitutional. Otherwise,
yes,
it's presumed constitutional. So
exactly.
Under the 8th and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, specifically, what do these amendments protect us from? And since the judge found as applied, after you tell us what those amendments protect us from, then tell us what that term as applied means.
Well, the 8th Amendment protects against cruel and unusual or unwarranted punishment. And so the argument was this lifetime punishment being imposed after the sentence was completed was cruel and unusual, especially with respect to the juvenile offenders. And then under the 14th Amendment, there was a substantive due process claim that this violated substantive due process, and then a procedural due process claim on behalf of Mr. Vega, who had tried repeatedly to petition off the registry since he was a juvenile offender, but was given that Kafkaesque, you know, catch 22 of the state court magistrate wanted him to prove that he would never commit another crime in the future before she would let him off the registry. And Judge Mage found that was a procedural due process violation. And what as applied means is that the statute isn't unconstitutional on its face. It's unconstitutional as applied to particular people given their particular scenarios. That's why I couldn't file this as a class action and didn't want to file it as a class action, because there's pretty decent arguments that the registry makes sense for people who are still on parole and on probation. But the issue is when you start applying these laws to people who have completely finished their sentences, are low risk, and have never committed another offense or even been accused of committing another sexual offense, then as applied to them, it's unconstitutional.
So I'm not able, after all my years of attending CLEs and being in this business, I'm not able to explain substantive due process versus procedural due process. So apparently Judge Bates found it violated both, correct? So is there any need for us to get into the difference between substantive and procedural due process, or can we go on to other things? But there are due process violations, and since I can't explain them, I'd be happy to hear.
Well, I mean, the substantive due process is very similar to the 8th Amendment. It has to do with whether you're being punished without due process of law. procedural due process means that there's no procedure that you're able to utilize to, you know, get your liberty back. And that was the big problem with Mr. Vega, was he was being put in this catch-22 by the state court judges of having to prove something that was impossible. So that was purely a procedural issue as opposed to a more substantive punishment issue. That's the best way I can explain it. I hope that makes sense.
Well, I noticed in the opinion that there was a quote that said that that the Supreme Court hasn't even fully explained the differences, but I know I'm not able to explain the difference. But let's talk about an as-applied challenge versus a facial challenge. A question we routinely get, and it was sent to me today, is why don't you just assert, get this thing over with once and for all, that registration is unconstitutional on its face? Can you explain the difference and tell us why you didn't assert a facial challenge and what it means, maybe even an example of how something could be, what type of statute would just be so clearly unconstitutional on its face that it could not stand, and why registration doesn't fit in that category?
Well, I mean, the reason why the plaintiffs lost in Smith versus Doe in the Supreme Court was because they did a facial challenge, and the Supreme Court said, well, on its face, the statute is constitutional because the state says this is how it's going to be applied and used, and there's nothing unconstitutional about that. It is pretty rare for a statute to be unconstitutional on its face. I'm trying to think of an outrageous example. For instance, if a statute says that if someone's accused of a certain type of crime, they can be imprisoned without a trial, that would be unconstitutional on its face.
Or if, for example, even something more people can relate to, like a religious prohibition, if we were to pass a law that says that you could not practice a certain type of religion in the United States, that would be
unenforceable. Exactly. Or we're going to ban Muslims from the country just because they're Muslims.
So those things, just looking at the statute, at the words, there would be no set of circumstances. And I believe that's the standard for a facial challenge to prevail. Isn't that there has to be no set of circumstances by which that could operate in a legal fashion, constitutional fashion.
Correct.
Okay, so do we not have registration schemes, or is it not conceivable that a registration scheme could be devised for sex offenders that would be so benign and so it would require so little? Could there not be a constitutional registration scheme devised?
Yes, absolutely. Registration for a short period of time, say a couple of years, and that is visible only to law enforcement. There's really no reason to publish this on the internet. Law enforcement might have a legitimate need for this information, and, you know, under those circumstances, I could see a registration statute being constitutional, or perhaps only publishing somebody who has five or more convictions. Somebody emailed me today about the Ohio drunk driving registry, where people with five or more drunk driving convictions are on a public registry. You know, if somebody cannot be rehabilitated, then maybe yes, then and only then, we would warrant having their names public and their pictures and their crimes public on the internet.
So you're ahead in the direction that we as an organization are very supportive of. I believe that the day may come when we can prove that just a mere publication of a person's likeness and their address is punitive on its face. But that would not end registration. That would end public registration.
But, exactly.
But to make sure I've clarified, a facial challenge to say that there's no set of circumstances which registration could be constitutional would fail. Do you agree?
I agree.
Okay. So, we're moving quickly, and I've only got a couple more questions, and then we're gonna be able to queue up for audience. Are the plaintiffs off the Colorado registry now, or do you expect that they will be soon?
Well, it's kind of in limbo right now. The Attorney General has to decide whether or not she's going to appeal. If she appeals, there's likely to be a stay pending appeal. If she doesn't appeal, then at least the three plaintiffs should come off the registry, and then we'll have a big battle as to the application of this opinion to other people.
So at this point, you've got one, Mr. Vega, who was a juvenile at the time of his offense, and the other two, they're still on there. But if there's no appeal, I know that it's a guessing game, but what do you think the likelihood is that there will be no appeal on this? Have you laid odds yet?
Okay, you know, I mean, every time I think about it, at first I thought, well, of course they're going to appeal. They always appeal. But maybe they're thinking strategically, and they're worried about getting a bad precedent in the Tenth Circuit, so that might be a reason why they don't appeal. If they want to try to aggressively limit the applicability and reach of this opinion, maybe they will decide not to appeal.
Well, let's hope they do that. Let's take the assumption both ways. If they do appeal, then potentially we have a disaster. The panel that you draw could actually do either one way. They could affirm or reverse. But if they do not appeal, and they let the decision stand intact, does this decision in and of itself have the potential to change registration requirements for other people in the entire state of Colorado or just these three?
Oh, absolutely. It has the potential to change registration for other people in the state. I think our Attorney General doesn't understand collateral estoppel or issue preclusion, but this is a case where the state of Colorado fought this every step of the way. For offenders who have completed their sentences, never committed any new crimes, and were low risk, they're going to be hard-pressed to relitigate that issue, the constitutionality of that issue, for similarly situated men and women on the registry. And this case could have a issue preclusive effect on that. But, you know, time will tell with that. There'll be lots of litigation in state and federal court. I've already filed a couple of motions in state court cases arguing that the judge should apply Judge Mache's argument and remove my client from the registry over the district attorney's objection.
So would you have any advice for people? Oftentimes we've learned that lawyers want to swoop in and take advantage of your work prematurely and start litigating cases. Do you have any advice for people in Colorado in terms of what they should do if they talk to a lawyer and their inclination is to initiate their own case? What would your advice be to anyone who's in Colorado that's impacted by registration at this point in time?
My advice would be first wait and see whether or not there's going to be an appeal. And second of all, don't jump back into federal court and start filing more 1983 cases yet. Let's see what happens in state court. File those motions and petitions to deregister in state court and motions to dismiss failure to register cases, because if we get a whole stack of orders from state court judges saying, I don't care what Judge Mache says, I'm not going to pay any attention to that, then I will have the ammunition I need to go back into federal court, even in front of Judge Mache, and say, okay, now we want a permanent injunction in joining the registry for this class of offender, and that would really gut the registry.
So do nothing at the moment, or file the regular removal petitions that are available for people that are eligible in Colorado. Is that correct?
Correct, and please stay in touch with me. I would like to be collecting those orders, good and bad, as people try to apply Judge Mache's case. Opinion in state court,
and then if anyone picks up a failure to register, then use this as this decision in defense of the FTR.
Yes.
Okay. We have Colorado actually set the record. Texas had the most people signed up, but Colorado surged ahead in the final hours of today. So we have a lot of people on here from Colorado, but we have a lot of people from out of the state and around the country. So. The people outside Colorado are going to want to know, can this case, this district judge in Colorado, can this case be used in their state?
Of course. I mean, I cited opinions from all over the United States, including the Sixth Circuit opinion in Snyder, various state Supreme Court cases in Ohio, Massachusetts, Maine, Alaska. It won't be like conclusive. It won't be the type of precedent that the judges in their state have to follow, but it will be very persuasive precedent, especially when it's cited with all of these other cases that have been coming down in the last 2 years that are very anti-registry.
So, the analysis he did is just spectacular. I mean, don't know who his law clerk is, but that's great work in analysis. I'm going to throw you a curveball here. Courts don't have a lot of resources to enforce their orders. What would happen if the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, the state of Colorado, were to simply thumb their nose at Judge Mates and go on with business as usual? Is there a process to force a person to comply with an order of a court after there's been a trial? I know we had a recent sheriff that thumbed his nose at court orders. So what would happen if the state of Colorado were to do this?
Well, we would be in kind of Joe Arpaio territory. Personally, I would not want to be a person who intentionally and deliberately defies Judge Mates's court order. I don't think he would hesitate in holding the CBI director in contempt. So that's another reason why I'm hoping that other people will proceed with caution and we build up our record for compliance so that we can make a good record in front of Judge Mates as to how state officials are complying or not complying with this order. And I really hope we don't get a lot of pro se litigation. There's a lot of bad case law is made from pro se litigation. I know that they're desperate and they mean well, but, you know, sometimes they're taken advantage of, and then we get some really bad precedent out of that.
So, well, I couldn't resist because the comparison is there, and you know, the defiance of the federal judge in Arizona, and then after the contempt proceeding and the finding, very specific findings, then there was the pardon. So I was just wondering, you know, that seems to set a precedent that others might be tempted to follow. So I hope that doesn't happen in this case. What we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and see if there are any attorneys on that want to hit *6, and I'm going to ask Allison if she has any final observations in addition to the questions I've asked, and then we're going to go to attorney questions and then Colorado questions. So, Allison, did you have anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to share with our listeners?
I don't think so. If anybody wants my pleadings or help, please don't call me. My voicemail is now overloaded. Please email me. My email address, Larry will have it, or I could give it out at the end, but I'll be happy to, you know, as much as I can, you know, share my pleadings and work and research files.
Well, we'll be happy to send out a follow-up email regarding this, and we can include your email in there. But please don't call her. I learned that lesson yesterday. I got an email: "Do not call me, Larry." So, if we have any attorneys that have hit *6, we want to get your questions out. And then we're going to go to preference to people in the state of Colorado. You don't actually have to be in the boundaries, but you have to have a connection to the registry, because this is important for those in Colorado to get their question in to Allison first. So are there any attorneys in the queue, Brenda? I'm not logged in tonight.
Well, since unfortunately all I have is phone numbers, I do recognize several that are not. I'll take the one that just came in since you asked for attorneys, and we'll hope that is an attorney.
Well, what we can do is we can ask each person to state where they're licensed, their name, and what state they're licensed. Attorneys are not going to want to be anonymous. And if you're not an attorney, we're going to ask you to drop out now, and we're going to get back to you next. But I would like to give the attorney some consideration here.
Yeah, if you are in the queue right now, that's a good idea, Larry. If you are in the queue right now, if you could press *6 again, I think that takes you back out of the queue. We want to have just the attorneys that have a question in the queue right now. So if you press *6, thank you. I do see some of you dropping. I appreciate that. I'll go ahead and pick the first person that hasn't dropped, and we'll go from there. Okay, you are on.
Hi, I am an attorney licensed in Colorado. I just wanted to ask a clarifying question about the suggestion to file motions to deregister in state court. Do you think if we have a potential plaintiff who's not yet eligible to deregister, they haven't hit their 5 or 10 years or whatever it might be, but they're one of those ideal plaintiffs that that you were mentioning, off parole, off probation, haven't hit the criminal justice system again, have been impacted by being on the registry, are you suggesting to go ahead and file that motion, or would we still, you think it's still best to wait for that time limit to come around, particularly if it's soon?
I that would be kind of up to the facts of the individual case. If they're close, you know, if they only had a 10-year registration requirement and they're close, why not wait the 10 years? But if they have a 20-year requirement and they're really suffering and, you know, having to wait another 10 years is really going to, you know, why not? You know, I don't see that there's anything to lose here.
Okay. All right, that's helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Okay,
that
thanks.
That was a quick and concise question.
Appreciate
great work.
It. Okay. This person's been on hold a while. If you're not an attorney, they didn't hang up, so I'm hoping that means that they're attorney.
Let's get their name and their state of practice.
There you go. You're on the air. Are you an attorney, sir?
I'm not an attorney.
Okay. All right. I'll move on to the next one, and then you can get back in the queue. Thanks for letting
Thank
us know. Okay. Bye-bye. All right. Next.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Ma'am,
yes.
You're here.
Yes, I am an attorney licensed in Wisconsin and Colorado, and my question is, will this Miller case have any effect on the sexual violent predator designation?
I don't think so, no. You know, it will have an indirect effect if you've got somebody who's an SVP and therefore they're ineligible to deregister at all, who kind of meets the requirements I set forth. I would recommend, filing a petition to deregister in state court and trying to make the argument that this is unconstitutional to make them register for the rest of their lives, but it's not going to do anything to take away that SVP designation.
Okay. And so, okay, well, I guess we don't really have time to go into that now, but unless you have any quick suggestions for how that can be dealt with, or can it be at this point? My understanding is it's extremely discretionary with the trial judge, and there's no recourse. Once he determines,
well, there's a recent Colorado Court of Appeals decision that just came out that said the SVP designation can be challenged under 35C. So I would encourage people to challenge those designations using that trio of Colorado Supreme Court cases that came out a couple years ago, making the standard more objective, to try to go back and undo some of those earlier SVP designations that really were very arbitrary.
Okay. And I just have one more quick question. Do you have any other cases in the pipeline right now regarding
I've got a litany of cases in federal courts involving the constitutional rights of sex offenders, mainly involving the rights of familial association. Those have been ongoing almost as long as this case has.
Okay. Okay, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take our next caller, who I hope is an attorney. State your license, sir. You're on.
Hi, I don't know if I'm on right now, but this is
Becky
Briggs in Colorado.
Yes.
I'm an attorney. And can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent.
Loud and clear.
That's so exciting. Okay, great. So, Allison, I actually have my first deregistration hearing tomorrow, and I'm trying to figure out the best way to weave in this order, if it's something that I should upload or just mention orally, or how do you think it's the best way to incorporate the new federal finding into the state deregistration hearings?
What county are you in?
Puebla.
Well, I mean, I would upload it and argue it directly and just say, and by the way, the sex offender registry is punishment. A federal judge has held that for this class of registrants, and also emphasize Judge Mace's analysis about shifting the burden of proof impermissibly to make the offender prove that he's no longer a risk and isn't going to commit any more crimes, and encourage the judge to not allow that to happen and point out that continuing to do that is a procedural due process violation.
All right, excellent. Well, I'm really excited, and I'll let you know how it goes after the hearing in the morning.
Okay, great. Great.
Thanks.
Thanks.
I'm really proud of our attorney questions.
We are. We've got, I think, one more. You are on the air.
Yes, this is King Alexander in Louisiana. I'm also licensed in California and Texas, but active in Louisiana only now. I beg your indulgence for asking a question I wouldn't have to ask if I had read your complaint. I have read the opinion and done some writing about it. I see that Judge Mace gave relief on Eighth Amendment and also both procedural and substantive due process. I thought that was fascinating, but what I couldn't tell, I guess he didn't talk about what constitutional grounds he might have rejected. So I wondered if those were the only three grounds that you raised, and if not, how you vetted the various constitutional claims. And I would just add that some other litigators around the country have had varying degrees of success on other constitutional grounds. So I'm just asking, how did you vet the constitutional grounds on which you were successful?
Well, those were the three grounds I raised. I did not. I expressly decided to stay away from ex post facto analysis because there's some tricky Tenth Circuit case precedent with respect to ex post facto, and I didn't want to get ensnared in that. And, you know, for these three plaintiffs, well, actually, ex post facto does apply to Mr. Millard because at the time he was convicted, he only had to register for 10 years and now has to register for life. What I decided I would do later on in a second lawsuit that I will file in Denver District Court is raise the ex post facto issue under the Colorado State Constitution because I have noticed that around the country, the state Supreme Courts are more likely to find an ex post facto violation than the federal courts. So that was the one constitutional ground that I did not raise, but I know has been successful in places like Rhode Island and California.
Excellent. Paul Dubling spoke at the 9th NARSOL conference in Atlanta, and he described using quite a list of constitutional rights, and he just went with the ones on which he got traction before his rather conservative district court judge. And I wondered if that might have been a factor. It's very interesting, and really you have surprised me because actually in Louisiana we would have better luck in federal court than with the state. There's, in fact, the head of the ACLU of Louisiana, Marjorie Esmond, agrees with me that we're just not interested in any state court litigation on these issues. That when you spoke earlier of intellectual dishonesty, then that is absolutely what we see there. And I think they don't talk about it, but I think part of it was that they were afraid of possibly losing federal money if they weren't retroactive. But now we see an interesting amicus against granting cert in Snyder versus Doe, in which the acting solicitor general says the state would not lose their federal funding if they got rid of the punitive or the things that are alleged to be punitive or that the Sixth Circuit held to be punitive in that case. going all the way to get a finding that not only is it punitive, but it's punitive in such a way that it violates the Eighth Amendment. I just have to congratulate you on. I'm sorry this doesn't sound like a question, but I just have to congratulate you on that. And substantive due process, that bowled me over. That's practically an extinct concept. So very interesting, but it sounds like your vetting was based on the jurisprudence of your particular circuit. And I'm in the Fifth Circuit, both for Louisiana and Texas, and that is part of our concern. And we don't want to step on the toes of bigger organizations in Texas and better funded. But we are looking for ways, and I agree with you about choosing plaintiffs who have finished their probation and parole obligations, because I feel something you didn't mention, it's just too dangerous for them. Do you agree?
I agree, yeah.
So those are great questions. That I agree with each of those positions. It's very risky litigating when you're still in the system. Thank you, King.
Thank you.
Glad you could make it.
Yes,
that is all
very glad
of the attorneys. Thanks.
Okay.
Is all of the attorneys. I do want to. Did you want to ask Colorado folks if
yes, we
who are
want to
not
give
attorneys,
all the preference to the people who are connected to Colorado. And like I say, you don't have to be in the geographical borders, but if you start asking mm-hmm. about Texas or Alabama, we're going to need to suppress your call and see if we can get to you
Move
later,
because
we want this to be related to this particular case and Colorado registration.
Okay, so I'm moving on to we've got one person again. We're pressing star 6 for those of you who are didn't catch that earlier. Star 6 gets you in the queue to ask a question if you are from Colorado or touching somehow on Colorado, so this case might affect you. Here's our first caller.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing? My question maybe this is a little bit naive on my part, but this whole case and so on was the offense occurred in Colorado. Is that correct? And the sentence, if you want to call it that, of the registration, that this would not necessarily affect people that have moved to Colorado that are required to register in another state initially and now have to register in Colorado?
No, it would affect anybody who has to register in Colorado, whether... You know, it doesn't matter where you're convicted. If you live in Colorado and you have a conviction, then you have to register in Colorado, and this case affects all those people.
Okay, but it wouldn't be, because it was a federal judge, would it have any bearing on the initial state where they have to register?
No.
Well, I mean, it matters where you live now. I mean, there's plenty of people who have moved to Colorado and now have to register in Colorado, and
Correct.
This affects them.
Okay, so regardless of where the offense was committed or where the initial registration was done.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, very good.
You know, when people get convicted in a state, it's difficult for them to understand that state loses control over them when they move to another state, because they're in a new regulatory scheme. They've left that state. And to my knowledge, only the state of Wisconsin continues to try to assert control and claim that you have to register with them after you've left the state, and they require you to continue reporting. But a decision to relieve you from Colorado registration would not be valid in the convicting state, because that was not a decision there's no jurisdiction there in the convicting state. So if Colorado's registration statute is unconstitutional, it's applied to a particular person, regardless of whether that conviction occurred in Colorado or not, that is not binding, because it may be that the registration scheme in Vermont is not punitive and does it may be within constitutional permissibility, so that's not going to remove the requirement in the convicting state.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah. I mean the law, you have to look at the law where you're currently living, and that's the law that's applied. And so for all of the offender, the 18,000 men and women who are on the Colorado registry are on it by virtue of living now in Colorado, regardless of where they were convicted.
Okay. And the only time they'd have to go back and register in their initial state is if they moved back to that state?
Exactly.
Unless you live in one of those states like Wisconsin that says send us your $50
right.
and fill this form out every year. And that I believe is subject to a constitutional challenge. If we find the right person and the financial resources, I would love to see that challenge because I don't believe they have jurisdiction to require registration once you leave the state of Wisconsin.
Okay. I have a lot more questions, but I won't take up any more of your time. I'll just email Allison and get more particulars on it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you,
sir.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we have another caller from appears to be from Colorado here.
Hello, Allison. I know we've talked many times. I've got basically two questions. One kind of touches on the question the last guy just asked. Do you see this as dealing a death knell to the registry in general so that at some point we will be able to travel state to state without worrying about this?
Well, this is an important first step. The Snyder case was an important first step. So, you know, we're not going to have the death knell until the Supreme Court overrules Smith versus Doe, which I think they're poised to do within the next decade. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I think that could very well happen.
Okay. You talked about the next step being, or one of your next steps being the ex post facto in state court. Do you see a timeline of that happening?
Yeah, I'm working with somebody who's helping me vet the plaintiff. We plan to have that underway by the end of the year.
Okay.
Okay.
That's it for me.
All right. Thanks very much. Next caller. Richard, I believe you had a question about Colorado. If you're not muted, I think you may be muted. He's going to get back in.
I was muted. Thank you for reminding me again. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Allison, congratulations on your great work. Certainly great applause went up around the country. I have the opportunity to talk with registrants all over the country, and I assume that many people in Colorado who are registrants feel quite the same. You encourage those not to file pro se. The issue that I think is out there and being ignored is that there are a lot of registrants who don't have the financial resources to hire lawyers. There are lots of lawyers who do not want to do cases without money, and the ACLU is not going to handle these cases. Why should they wait? You know, if they got the ability to file pro se, I mean, these people are under stress and duress, and I'm certainly, I know you know this, and you've dealt with many hardship cases, but what about these people who are going through this duress, and the lawyers are saying, well, don't file a case because we're doing something, and I mean, you just said that maybe in the next 10 years the Supreme Court is going to, you know, have a change of heart. I mean, isn't 10 years a long time?
Yeah. No, I know. I understand perfectly. There are people out there that can't afford a lawyer, that they can't find a lawyer. I guess what I'm hoping to discourage a little bit more of is there's some people, especially who are in the Department of Corrections, that just file these lawsuits for entertainment, and they've done quite a bit of damage. As a collateral consequence, and there's no other option except for them to try to go pro se. Well, of course I understand that everybody's got the right to access to the courts, but you know, just keep in mind that pro se litigation can have some very adverse consequences.
I'm wondering if you could to explain just a little bit more what the adverse consequences are, you know, balanced on top of the fact that, you know, as Richard's pointing out, that sometimes there's, you know, there's so much pain, and that's part of the reason why a pro se person might want to go ahead. So what would you say are the key risks of pro se litigation, you know, that they should weigh before they file a case?
Well, and this is especially true with some Tenth Circuit case law. You know, they mean well, but they just don't know enough or know how to research the law well enough, and then they get to the Tenth Circuit and they don't make the best argument they can make, or they don't argue the correct precedent, and then, you know, they just get steamrolled over by the Attorney General, and then you get a very bad and one-sided opinion out of the Tenth Circuit that may be published that really didn't analyze the issue as well as it could have. And then you've just got some bad precedent that's that much more difficult for people in the future to overcome. And so, you know, I mean, we're not going to be able to prevent, you know, pro se litigation. And
sure,
there are some pro se litigants out here in Colorado who, you know, win cases. And, you know, they almost every month there's at least one unpublished Colorado Court of Appeals decision by a pro se DOC inmate, where they win. But, you know, there's also some very, very bad case law out there. Every time I'm in the Tenth Circuit trying to argue some of these issues, it's more likely than not I'm having to argue against a bad precedent that happened as a result of a pro se litigant who was just in over his head.
Yeah, I know that I have heard that, you know, being the case, and it's hard for us non-legal people to fully understand, you know, but there's just so many bits and pieces, as I see it, in any piece of litigation. You know, you're researching all kinds of stuff, and no matter how hard we might have worked to learn the law on our own, you know, arguing a case and supporting it and providing the right documentation and making sure you're using the right vehicle, I guess is the word, you know, all of those things, and a loss is a loss, and it has just as much impact if it's pro se versus, you know, the best top-notch, high-paid attorney out there. So if it's a loss, you know, it goes into the record, and then somebody else has got to come along and clean up the mess, and it could take three times longer. So I know that happens. So I did want to just kind of clarify that a little bit. Thank you, Richard. I did have to mute you earlier because you were getting a lot of background noise, so hopefully that was the end of your question. We do have one more person from Colorado, and there you are. So what's your question, please?
This is Allison.
Yep.
Hi, Allison. I met with you and Tracy at a legal clinic, and I'm in a different category. I was sentenced and I believe completed my sentence before any of this registration started, and then I was thrown into this mix. I was wondering what where I stand right now with this, if there's a different route we need to look at, or I was sentenced in 1993 and completed my sentence in 1998.
Well, if you completed your sentence in 1998, then the statute does apply to you. But you are one of those people with a valid ex post facto challenge, and so that's what this second lawsuit, where we're going to be challenging ex post facto, will be. You know, you're in that class of people that will be directed at.
Okay, yeah, because they switched me from, there was no pre-bargain or anything in the court with the registration process, and then all of a sudden I get these letters years later saying, okay, now you've got to register for the rest of your life. So, okay, that answered that a little bit. So that'll be in the next lawsuit that you're doing.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. We have one very patient person.
Oh, hi. It's It's Cindy from Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for being on tonight and all your hard work. I am not a legal person, and I do have a few questions, and they're short. One of your things about having that class of offender, how, and typically in Colorado, what are your terms of either parole or probation? Do you know what, is there a standard? Like in Connecticut, we have sort of across the board 10 years and on up. We have very long suspended sentences and probation.
Yeah, in Colorado we have lifetime supervision. So the majority of people on probation or parole are serving 10 to life or 20 to life. And while it's possible to petition off either probation or parole at the 10 or 20 year mark, it's not easy. So yeah, these people are a lot of people are serving very long sentences. And but I just don't see a way to challenge the registry requirement while they are serving those sentences. I think those sentences themselves are too long, and sooner or later the Colorado legislature is going to have to address that because it's just ridiculously expensive too. But, you know, registration is just only one small part of the package that these people have to contend with 10 or more years.
Well, what we find in our state, and it sounds like, I mean, across the board, many places probably, is the disproportionate. You know, if you're a 10-year term on the registry and or a lifetime, that's where we're at in Connecticut today, it's very disproportionate. You can petition when you're a lifetimer, the reform might be 10 years. But if you're a 10-year term, you can petition after 5 years. And it just seems very disproportionate for the low-level offenses or those low-risk people. Okay,
well,
my other question.
I
have two more questions.
Yeah, some other ones, yeah. We've got
very quickly, the proliferation of private registries. You know, once you're on the registry, I don't see you can get off that Colorado registry, but you're still out there. Probably people who are dead are on registries. So what, what can we do to protect ourselves or go after those companies? And my last question is, besides getting off the registry, is there any case here for getting damages?
Well, I'm not going to pursue the damages issue. Then you open up a whole can of worms with qualified immunity. Then you have to have a jury trial. And I could see filing a case for damages against a vigilante who causes direct harm as a result of information he found on the registry. But I'm not going to sue the government for damages. That's just that would just be counterproductive, in my opinion. Regarding these private registries, it's like case sealing. They're constantly updating their database with the current registrant. So after a couple of months or a year, the majority of people who are off the registry then fall off these private databases too. But you know, there's no way to compel them to take you off of their private database.
Which is
okay,
has been which has been a thorn in our sides, you know, for quite some time. My state is certainly in that ballpark. We removed lots of people with the retroactivity claim, and it was even driving the people on the public safety, you know, even the public safety people were going, but they won't take them off. That's just not right. So, all right, I just want to pause a moment, Larry. We do seem to have pretty much wrapped up the Colorado folks, and I'm starting to get a number of people calling from around the country, but I did want to check in with you
on time. We actually
have
non-Colorado people on this batch, but now it's open to general questions, but there again, please ask about this case. That would be very helpful because Ms. Ruttenberg is not prepared to talk about the law in Louisiana or any other state, so please ask about this case. and what its impact
this case,
may be.
The impact in Colorado, this
or,
10th Circuit.
Or something related to this case. But when you start telling a story about how bad things are in Florida, down on the Julia Tuttle, we know that, and we're very sympathetic to it. But this case won't fix that.
Okay. All right. With that caveat, we're ready to go ahead and move on to the next person, if you are. Okay. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Hey, I appreciate the advice that the question needs to relate, of course, to the Colorado case. And while I'm calling from Pennsylvania, I'm looking simply for an opinion, a personal opinion or what have you, as to whether or not the decision in the Colorado case we've been discussing could potentially impact the situation, which I'll summarize for you in 10 seconds. In Pennsylvania, there was a Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision involving an individual by the name of Muniz. And as a result of that decision, it shot down, if you will, a retroactive application of STORNA to folks whose offense was prior to 2012. Pennsylvania, the district attorney in the county involved, Cumberland County, may potentially file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's Muniz decision. And with all that said, I'm simply wondering, because I don't know relationships, if they exist between state courts and federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm simply speculating as to whether the Colorado decision being issued by a federal judge would have any impact on the likelihood or not that the Pennsylvania DA would file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court from the Muniz decision, again issued by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And I'm wondering that simply because, in light of what I just said, I'm wondering whether since this Colorado decision, and I forget the individual's name of the case that you've been talking about, I'm wondering, though, since that decision was issued by a federal court, the fact that such a decision was issued, indicating that being on the, at least Colorado registry is, unconstitutional.
We have the question.
Yeah, we got the question.
Okay. Would that impact?
Let me try to answer that. This decision, I don't think, will affect your attorney general's actions, but it will affect the likelihood of whether the Supreme Court will take the case or not. The U.S. Supreme Court is looking for issues where there's a sharp division among the federal courts and the state Supreme Courts on a particular federal constitutional issue. So this is one more strong case in the column of the registries are punishment, and therefore that affects ex post facto, the retroactive application, and other constitutional issues versus on the other side of the ledger where state Supreme Court or a federal court holds that, no, the registries are not punishment and therefore can be retroactively applied. So, yes, I would expect this Colorado case to be cited and argued in U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence coming up, not only in that case, but also the Snyder case. I expect that appellees and Snyder will be supplementing their briefing in the U.S. Supreme Court to allege that, well, now we have yet another federal court coming down on the side that the registry's punishment.
So if I may, the Supreme Court, the federal U.S. Supreme Court would consider most likely the Colorado decision and other decisions issued by federal judges elsewhere.
Yeah, it very well could, and I would expect it to be cited by the lawyers who are arguing the case in favor of Mr. Muniz. This would just be another, good case in the column of cases coming down against the registries. So certainly
it's
going
to
have that indirect effect.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a lot of questions. Larry, give me a timeline.
Try to make the questions a little shorter than that one. Because we're trying to get to as many as we can. And Allison, I think, can stay with us another 10 minutes or so.
I could stay on a few minutes past 6, past 6 o'clock if you want. I've got another 20, 25 minutes if there's a lot of questions.
Everybody try to confine your question, make it a little more compact.
Okay. We have a next caller on.
Hi, Allison. This is Mark from Loveland, Colorado. We talked 4 or 5 years ago after a compliance check, so it's been a while. My question is, because I've been listening to this, what, you know, if a registrant's off paper, off probation, and what would you recommend their next steps be as far as at this point? And then second part of the question is, I've been off paper for about 6.5 years. Do you think this will help the petition process as we at the 10-year marks trying to petition to get off the registry?
Yeah, hi, Mark. I was actually considering calling you as a witness at trial and then decided that I had enough evidence, because what you described certainly is one of the more outrageous ways that police officers abuse the registry. But, you know, I'd certainly be willing to talk to you privately again. I think we can use this decision to try to petition to get you off the registry sooner than the 10 years and claim that it's unconstitutional as applied to you, especially with the way the Loveland Police Department is behaving.
So that sounds like a good thing would be to contact Allison by email afterwards and see if you guys can pursue that. And I did notice in the judge's decision that the Denver Police Department is fond of using those bright colored flyers that we have sheriffs in New Mexico use that are so obnoxious that put sex offender unit was here on people's doors after they pound until every dog in the neighborhood's barking. I saw that's not just something that happens here.
Yeah, it happens all over Colorado.
So it's very obnoxious, very very obnoxious, and it causes problems for people. And I had an issue with that myself, but I dealt
in
with
color, it. Hi, this is Greg. And in Colorado, if someone has their record set aside, are they still required to register?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that question. Can you say that
record
again?
Satisfied? Is that what you said?
In Colorado, I was just wondering if someone has their record set aside or expunged.
Satisfied.
Are they still required to register?
Well, there's no way to set aside or expunge a sex conviction in Colorado. If you had a deferred judgment and sentence in Colorado and you successfully complete that deferred judgment and sentence and the case is dismissed, then unfortunately, yes, you still have to register. You have to affirmatively petition to get off the registry, which I think is outrageous, and another example of what I mean by the Colorado Court of Appeals being a little bit intellectually dishonest.
I live in Michigan, and in Michigan, you know, you are able for certain situations. I had a misdemeanor, and it was set aside. I was eligible to have it set aside, but I'm still required to register for life, even though it was a misdemeanor, and I technically have no record. So it just seems to me like that there's pretty good challenge for a constitutional challenge.
I would think so. Hopefully we can come up with one somewhere and get that across the country. Okay, thanks. All right, we got a few more questions. So let me move on to the next.
Hi, this is Michael from Indiana. Just a real quick question. I also would like to congratulate you, first of all, on your victory, and thank you for what you're doing. But I just was interested in how we can obtain the complaint information that you filed with the court to use in our states.
Well, yeah, I think Larry's going to distribute my email after this phone conference. Email me. I will send you the opinion and the complaint. It might take me a day or two if I get inundated with emails, but I will do my best.
Well,
and of
Allison,
course, all the
Allison, we could post it on our website. I pulled down your Fourth Amendment complaint. Is that the one you would most want to disseminate?
Yeah, I would also post the Third Amendment complaint too. There was some good stuff in there. So yeah, post all that stuff. Download it from the website. If you get a ways into the litigation and have a question or want my research file, I mean, I can also supply that by email as well.
So, okay. So, thank you very much.
Well, I'll get the third complaint, and we'll figure out. I'm not a tech geek, but we'll figure out how to make that accessible to the world. It's accessible
sure.
to the world now if you have a Pacer account.
Yeah. Well, what I would suggest, we always put, thanks, Michael, we always put the recordings up on the webinars page under, you know, there'll be one for NARSL in action, and I'd say we could certainly put a link there, and then we also have another page on the site for, you know, good court cases and such, so we'll have it in two different places, and we'll just link to it from there. So that's
We already have the opinion on the website. We just don't have the complaint.
It's
the complaint that I'm interested in. So.
Right. Understood.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Take the next caller here. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jim Prager. I'm in Ohio. And our Ohio legislation is currently considering starting what they call a violent offender registry in addition to the sex offender registry. I've written testimony opposing it and wonder if I should include what happened in your decision. Would that be something that would dissuade our legislature from moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, the more ammunition, the better, certainly.
Okay. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your great work. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next caller.
Yes, hi. This is Stefan in California. I was convicted and sentenced in California. I got off parole 20 years ago. But my daughter and grandkids live in Broomfield, Colorado, and I'm reticent to go there because if I go there for more than a few days, I have to register. Can I now go there and assume that if for some reason I come to the attention of the police, I can argue your court case and try to avoid having to register in California if I want to visit?
I think that'd be a little bit dangerous. I would, you know, because the registry is still in full force and effect, and you could pick up a failure to register here, and then we'd have to, you know, file a motion to dismiss and litigate it. I think you could visit for 5 days here without having to register.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There would also be a potential of a federal prosecution because that would be an interstate, interjurisdictional travel where there may be implications in federal law that he didn't comply with a registration obligation, and that's the place where you don't want to be is in federal court for criminal charges. That is
criminal. Yeah. So. All right. Thanks. We did get another caller. You're on. Are you there? I think you may have muted yourself.
We'll come back to you.
Well, hopefully they'll figure it out. If you have any random questions, that was our last person in the queue. So,
what I would say is if there's nobody else in the queue and he doesn't come back, that we can do a summation of just how fantastic this is. It's not the cure-all, end-all, as Allison has said. It is a giant step of steps that we will continue to be taking to challenge the registry and the overreaches of the registry. Allison, did you want to there's people joined us all throughout the call and people dropped off. Would you be kind enough to give your advice again about what you're telling people in Colorado that have direct connections to registration, what not to do and what to do, what your advice is, because there's new people on here?
Well, I would first recommend waiting 60 days to see whether or not there's going to be an appeal. And I would recommend right now not filing any more civil rights lawsuits in federal court. But first, if you're interested in getting off the registry and using this opinion to petition in the court where you have your conviction to get off the registry and use this opinion and argue that registration is unconstitutional. And then, you know, because we're trying to build up a library of opinions from state court judges to see whether they're going to allow the state to continue to relitigate this issue, or whether they're going to follow it, or whether they're going to ignore it. If we get a stack of state court opinions from around the state where the state courts are just say, we don't care what Judge Mate says, we're not going to follow it, we're going to allow the district attorney and the attorney general to continue to relitigate this issue, then I will have the ammunition to go back to Judge Mate and get some kind of an injunction against the registry itself, which would really cause problems for the attorney general. So that's how I recommend proceeding, at least for now.
So, Allison, I just got a text from a person who I know has a Colorado conviction. So hit star six, and we can squeeze that question in from the person, and we'll see if we can answer it.
All right. I do have – I'm going to try real quickly to see if our person managed to get themselves unmuted. Are you there? And then if not, I've got one other person, and maybe they're the one who – press
well,
star
it
six.
Would be on area code 575 for the one that just
passed. Okay, it. That person came in as well. I'm going to go ahead and press next. I think that gets the previous
Hello.
Person. Yes, so you had a question
yes.
related to
Yes, hi, Colorado? Allison.
Okay.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Do you have
yes,
a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. My thing is, how can we get everybody combined together on this, especially doing mandamus to seek relief and keep the pro se thing down, maybe get the different states all together and find some attorneys that are good like Allison to help people with low incomes and kind of get this all put together, because it's kind of a common sense general thing that looks like it's starting to go through the courts and they're starting to recognize, you know, like the ex post facto and all that kind of thing. How can we get everybody on the same page and make it easy and cheap for people due relief to keep the, you know, like the state police or whoever's in charge of the registries from doing delay tactics and keeping people on there when they're due relief?
Okay. That's, yeah. So a mandamus that would apply to multiple people. Yeah. Go ahead.
I wish there was a general simple solution. There just isn't. I mean, you know, I hope my colleagues will step up and continue to litigate this issue around the country. But until the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Smith versus Doe, the only way we can do this is on a case-by-case basis.
Well,
would there be a type of generic mandamus thing? Like, say, the Muniz decision, now it has a stay until they decide if the U.S. Supreme Court's going to actually take the appeal. If they decide that they're not taking the appeal, then there's a lot of people due relief. Is there some way for people to do a mandamus and force Pennsylvania State Police to take people off the registry? Because that's one of the things I'm seeing happen, and I'm sure it's going to happen in Colorado with your cases. They just drag it out as long as possible and keep everybody on there as long as they can.
Well, I mean, I don't think there could be like a class action. I think a Pennsylvania attorney is going to help with that specific issue with that case. Here in Colorado, There just is going to be no way to file any type of broad class action, because the issue of whether or not a particular person is being punished and therefore the registry is unconstitutional as pertains to them, those are very fact-intensive. And so I don't see a way to pursue that as a class action. Yeah, and if you're talking about like putting together like a packet of kind of template pleadings, that's a great idea. If would be willing to help work on that. That'd be something that I think would be a good project, you know, state by state, but, you know, that would take a lot of work.
So, well, we're going to need to zip through the rest of the questions. We're running out of time, so thank you for yours.
Yeah.
And there's one or two more waiting.
There was, unfortunately, the person that you asked seems to have dropped back out again, Larry. If you're still there, sir, or ma'am, do press star 6 again. I'm not sure if I did that or if you did it, but you dropped. I do have one other, hopefully, a quick question. Oh, maybe this was it. So you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I first of all, I want to thank you tremendously for all the work you've done. My question is in regard to, I am one of those individuals that is in a very good position to be addressed in court as far as being deregistered, I believe. My case happened in 2004. I was sentenced to a 4-year indeterminate sentence. I was held for 8.5 years.
We're trying not to tell stories here. Now, if you can, what's the question?
I understand. I'm now 14 years into my sentence. My question is, when does a person's time of supervision begin? At the beginning of your sentence or at the time of your release? I'm now 14 years into my sentence with a 20-year supervision attached to my case. So when does that supervision time begin? And so that gives me an idea when to readdress this in court.
So are you on parole right now?
Yes.
Okay. So under state law, you're not going to be eligible to petition to get off the registry until 10 years after you get released from parole, which is probably decades in the future for you. But like I explained earlier, it's going to be hard to convince a court that the registry is unconstitutional for people who are still serving their parole sentence, because the registration requirement is only one of a number of these parole requirements, and many of the other parole requirements are even more austere and punitive than the registration requirement. For people who are serving long periods of time on parole and are effectively, you know, get into their 10th, 15th year on parole and are barely being supervised anymore, I think in the future that might be an issue. But I don't think it's an issue that can be addressed now. That's why I'm only litigating this issue on behalf of people, at least right now, who are off paper, who are off parole and off probation.
Okay. So the time begins at the end when you are released, though.
From parole, yes.
Yes. Okay. So, that's it in a nutshell. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I think Allison's time is up, but we do have a couple more questions, so we're not going to impose.
We can take a couple more questions.
Okay,
that's
Allison.
Okay.
All right.
The quicker the question, the quicker we can get through.
Yep. Quick questions.
Hello?
Go ahead. Yep. Go ahead.
First of all, I'm normal. I was wrongfully convicted, so my life has been hell. Secondly, I was convicted in California. I had a very successful life here in Colorado. I went out there on a scholarship, landed up in prison, came back here on parole, lost my houses and everything I had. The problem I have now is the county that I live in is very vindictive, very misconduct oriented as far as how they treat people in my position, because it's a wealthy county, if you will. So they're not used to people being homeless per se. So I was actually told a couple times at my registration that I dressed too nice, quote unquote, to be homeless. And so they don't understand how my life is unraveled. From being successful to being completely homeless. I've worked my ass off to get where I'm at today. And the problem I'm having is the police are obviously keeping me under their magnifying glass simply just to generate more convictions, to keep me on this thing so I'm indefinitely in their system and paying money and unable to move forward in my life.
That's my question, and that's my concern. I'm also disabled, and half the time I can't even make it to register there. So they also hold that against me because I can't physically do it. They don't have technology to do this over the phone.
What is the question exactly?
What can I do to, like, kind of like the gentleman in Pennsylvania suggested, can I use this to argue with an attorney about how they're vindictively keeping me on this just because of the way they're treating me? I was the poster child for perfect attendance, and this is the thing I got.
Well, okay, sir, so what you can certainly you do? Sound like you've got a good case for arguing that continued registration is punishment and unconstitutional. I know there are attorneys in California who are filing lawsuits regarding that.
No, I'm in Colorado now. I'm a Colorado resident, and honestly, they treated me better in California. But God forbid I come home to where I live and was chased out with basically torches.
Well, ask Larry, get my email when Larry sends out the email at the end of this conference call. Email me. Well, what county are you in?
I was forced to move to Denver. Originally, I was a resident of Arapahoe County. I paid taxes and did my thing, and my crime's not even in Colorado, and this is the treatment I get simply for moving back here.
Okay.
Well, I'd be willing to talk to you privately if you are you allowed.
Sure.
Do you have email?
Excellent. Yes, ma'am. I have a way to get a hold of you. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay.
So email me
All
directly.
Right.
I'll be willing to talk to you privately about this.
Sure.
All right.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have two more callers.
Just
say when.
Yeah, I'm ready, but try to get to the question because we're on borrowed time now.
Yeah. I know you want to try to set the tone, but yeah, just kind of cut straight to the question. Okay, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you're here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm actually trying to get clarity. I understand of the Megan's Law and the Adam Walsh Act or whatever. I'm trying to see which one determined how long you're going to be on the registry. Is it the Adam Walsh Act or is it the Megan's Law itself?
It's whatever the state calls it. Your state law decides how long it is. I can answer that one for you. It doesn't matter whether it's Megan's Law or, I mean, it's just Megan's Law is what some states call it. Adam Walsh Act is what other states call it. But in the end, it's just whatever it says in that statute in your state.
Okay, no problem.
How'd I do, guys?
Thanks a lot.
You didn't mind.
Sure.
I would only add to that would be that if the state has incorporated within its state statutory scheme that the periods will be no less than the Adam Walsh Act. And I think there's a state or two that has done that. But otherwise it's like registered your car. It's how much they charge you and what the terms are for registering your car. You go to the state. Some states charge a huge amount of registration fees and taxes, and some charge relatively little.
So it's up to your
state.
You never know. Yep.
Okay, good
old
Illinois.
That's why it's so confusing. It's they call it different things in different states, but yeah, in the end, it's what your state law says. Okay, we do have one more question. Thank you. Go ahead. You're on.
Yeah. Hello. Good evening. My name is Angel. I'm from New Jersey, and my question is probably similar to the gentleman that just spoke. My conviction was in '91. In New York City, and I was under the 10-year under the Megan's Law previously, but then when it became SORNA, it went up to 20 years. So can I use the Colorado decision to try to get out of the registry?
Well, it sounds like you've got an ex post facto issue. Frankly, the better precedent for you would be that Snyder case out of the Sixth Circuit, because that deals with ex post facto issues directly, and that was one constitutional issue that I did not litigate in my case. But there's some very good precedent for you to argue of these ex post facto issues, but I strongly urge you to find an attorney in New York to help you with that.
Okay, awesome. So use the Snyder case with an attorney, hopefully from New York, and use some of the good stuff that's in the Snyder case to try to get off the registry.
Yes.
Well, now, are you
Thank
registering
you
in New Jersey or New York?
Well, presently I'm registering in New Jersey,
But if
New Jersey attorney, an attorney where you're registered.
Yeah, New Jersey is 20 years. I got like one more year to get the 20 years. But even if I do in New Jersey get off, I still have to go to New York and do the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, you definitely need an attorney then to get that sorted out.
I got to deal with Allison. I don't mean to keep you over, but you wouldn't have to do anything in New York if you're not living there.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm living in Jersey.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
So you wouldn't have to file anything in New York to get off the registry. If New Jersey releases you, then you have to be cognizant that you may be covered by another state statute. But even if New York, if you filed pursuant to whatever process they have in New York, that wouldn't be valid in Alabama. It wouldn't be binding on them. So if you moved to Alabama, whatever New York decided wouldn't be binding on them. So it's a real convoluted mess.
Yeah, it's tough because what happened, when I moved to New Jersey, I got my level lower in New Jersey courts. And then when I contacted the New York courts, they said, no, buddy, you have to come here and see if we can lower your level here. So it's all mixed up. I'm like really confused.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah.
So I think we're going to conclude.
Thank you.
We had a very, very good call, and it's been fun. And we're grateful that Allison, you could spend so much of your time with us. Send a bill to our Colorado affiliate. They have plenty of money, and they'll be happy to reimburse you for your time.
Okay.
That was a joke.
Susan, I'll pack that on to my attorney fee bill.
Susan will be happy with that. And then I'm going to ask if Brenda has anything that she wants to say to the people remaining. But Allison, it was so nice of you. We really appreciate what you've done. You're a true, dedicated person. Your experience of what you've been doing with your career speaks to that. And just thank you for what you've done. And we hope that we can be there to help you if you need any. As this case, if there were to be an appeal, we have some loyal donors out there, and we feel like we could help you with some of the finances. So don't hesitate to contact us if you need our help.
Okay, we'll do.
So.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll just close by thanking everyone for hanging out. Everybody's dropping right and left now since we've wrapped up the questions and answers. But I do want to thank all of you for being on the call, and we'll look forward to talking to you on our next webinar. I have nothing to announce, so we'll just end it there. And thanks again, and we'll see you again soon. Larry, and you'll be sending out the via email, I assume,
I'm typically slower than I hope. Hopefully within 48 hours we can get out an email thanking people and giving information. So,
and
that'll be to everybody who was registered. If you weren't registered, you will not get this email.
If that's the case, send a message to contact at narsil.org and say, I want to get that information. They'll get it to us. All right. Thanks very much, and have a good